Let me just begin with an apology. You'll notice I took my shoes off. I shouldn't apologize for that because this is holy ground. And if you don't take your shoes off, you will die. So, no, actually, it's simply because it's more comfortable. When I used to teach theology, I'd prance around up in front, and I found out that my feet only have so much endurance, and it's a whole lot more comfortable in stockings than in shoes. So, here I am. You forget what you say, but let me tell you, your congregational singing is just terrific. And I can't tell you how important that is. Now, you know that those of us, I've heard the speakers you've had here before, and of course Joe is on, we're on line together, and a number of us have been fraternizing in one form or another together for a lot of years. So you hear a lot of similar things. And you're probably not going to hear anything from me that would just be totally out of the ballpark because we've all hung around together too much with each other. But let me begin here, and this is where I will begin today, and in a sense, this is where I will end today. The kind of congregational singing that you are doing, the importance of that cannot be overemphasized. And the recovery of this sort of, you know, when you're singing, what are you really doing? You're doing spiritual warfare. And you are really praying. And you are really doing this before the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, all of the angelic host, and the principalities and powers. And historically, do you know who some of... I remember a number of years ago, I went to a conference. I've been a chaplain in one form or another in various contexts. And I've had a lot to do with law enforcement people in Boulder, as well as the medical community. And I remember a number of years ago, I went to a chaplain's conference for police officers and sheriffs, for law enforcement officers. And one of the chaplains who was there had been a chaplain when the Oklahoma City bombing happened. How many years ago was that? I can't even remember. But you remember the terrible bombing. And he was one of the people called in to minister in the midst of that. And I remember he said to me, we had some private conversations. He had a lot to share about what it meant to be a chaplain to police officers in that context. But he said to me, he said, you know, the junk, this interesting metaphor, he said, the junkyard dogs of the church have always been the psalm singers. And that's a, you know, a junkyard dog. You know what? You know, if your life goes back to the time of American Graffiti when everybody was building hot rods, I'm that old. Yeah. And that town that was Modesto, California, I think. That could have been my hometown. Those kids were the kids of my high school. And of course, what every hotshot did who was building a hot rod was he broke into the junkyards and stole transmissions or whatever. So you had these mean dogs there who would keep anybody out. But that's an interesting metaphor. And historically, if we look at what the psalm singers have done, to my knowledge, the first psalm singers, at least they had to have been very early. Does anyone know what the first Roman, well, we would say Roman Catholic now, but that's a post-Reformation perspective. Does anybody know what the first monastic order was in the Western Church? You know? They're still around. The Benedictines. Benedictines. And they're still... See, nothing ever disappears. Benedictines are still around. Every Roman Catholic church in Boulder Valley, where I come from, was established by the Benedictines. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to drive down to see my uncle and grandmother in a little town called Florence, Colorado, which is near another town called Canyon City, which happens to be where the state prison is in Colorado. But there used to be a... There's not anymore, but there used to be a Benedictine monastery there. And I'd go in there every time I went down there because they would sell books, and you could get books there for like a dollar that you couldn't find anywhere else on earth. So I always went to their little book sale. But you'd walk into that place and you felt like you were in the 12th century with electric lights. So the whole world, you see, the whole world is really made up of these layers. And God keeps putting a new layer on top of all these other layers. And any of these layers in the Christian world can be called up again when need be. But what is significant about the Benedictines? They were the first monastic order. It was brothers. They were celibate. And you know what we now call Europe, as the Roman Empire was collapsing, and Rome was sacked about 430, 450, somewhere in the 5th century. Rome was sacked, which is one of the most horrific events in the history of the world. Rome was really the center of civilization. Now, Jerusalem may have been the center of the world spiritually, but politically and in terms of a civilization that was visible, Rome was. Only two cities in the world had 1 million people or more at the time of the Apostle Paul. One of them was Rome, the other one was Xi'an in China. Xi'an, it was the end of the Silk Trail, which got cut in two by the Muslims in the 6th century. So the Eastern and Western world got cut off. But two cities of 1 million people or more, Rome was one of them. So with the collapse of Rome, you began to see a very high civilization decline. And there was, it was a move into a Dark Ages. And those Benedictines, they moved from Italy into what we would now call Italy. Of course, these didn't have national boundaries, but they began to move northward. And what they did was they would chop down the woods, these dark forests. And forests were places that were inhabited by demons and dark forces and dark powers. And they would chop down they would clear the land, and they would build a manor house, and then they would farm. And from that manor house, their principal spiritual work, they farmed and they chanted the Psalms around the clock. And what they waited for were the barbarians to make contact with them. And over and over and over again, the Benedictine brothers were martyred. And over about 400 or 500 years, do you know what happened? All those barbarians got converted. And they became the foundation of what we now call Europe. And this whole barbarous world, and it was truly a barbarous world. And by the way, most of us here are Anglo, we are white people, and these are our ancestors. And they were as tribal as the Apache, the Sioux, the Navajo, anything you would find in North America. The same kind of configuration of human beings. Very, very similar. Wild, barbaric, warrior people, and they were civilized, and they were brought to the Christian faith by people who did spiritual warfare singing the Psalms. So, congratulations. I mean, really, your congregational singing is just terrific, and what you're doing is very, very important. Now, what I want to talk about, because we're talking about transitions today, I want to talk about another transition. And I know I've got to watch my time here, so I will try to do that. I want to talk about Book of Judges. And there are several, you know, everything is context. There's not just one take on the Book of Judges. There are several takes you can make on it. This is not the final word on Judges, but it's one perspective that I think is helpful. Does anybody know who the traditional author of the Book of Judges was? Who do the Jews say wrote the Book of Judges? Anybody know? Ah, Samuel. Now that is significant. You know what you have? We have books that are called the Chronicles. But by and large, there is what the Hebrews, I use the word advisedly, what they invented is astonishing. Well, I mean, really, nobody else. There's no other book like this. There's no other book that is the source of so many things that we now just take for granted. It's like breathing the air because it's become so much a part of us. But we've forgotten where it came from. And really, before the Hebrews, there is no such thing as the writing of history. There are chronicles. Now, that's what I said. In the Bible, we have books called chronicles. But the chronicles are actually more than chronicles. What chronicles means, essentially, is one thing after another, without any particular meaning. And in fact, if you were a pagan, there really wasn't any meaning to anything because everything just went in big circles. It wasn't really going anywhere. It wasn't developing anything. You might get circles that were bigger or circles that were smaller, but things were going in circles. So even what are called the chronicles in the Bible are actually history. Now, it's very significant. History is very significant. What we call history is very significant. Winston Churchill, for example, for instance, who we know is a great writer of popular history. He wrote the history of World War II. He wrote the history of the British people of the British Isles. He's a very good popular historian. He said at one point about the administration that preceded him that they would go down in history as villains, and somebody said, "How do you know, Mr. Churchill?" And he said, "Because I will write the history." And he did. And he wrote the history to make a particular point. And if you read the great historians, the great epic historians that come out of the 19th century, they're all writing. There's very little of that now. That's why you bring up a name like Rosenstock Huessy. He is one of the few. And he's writing. He wrote history from an explicitly biblical perspective to make a biblical point. But as to quote Rosenstock Huessy again, if you do not have Jesus Christ, you are lost in time. Jesus Christ is your compass in time. You cannot navigate through time if you do not have Jesus Christ and do not know Him. So who wrote particular books it's very significant. So who, for example, is the traditional author of 1 and 2 Kings? Anybody know? Pardon? No. Pardon? It's a prophet. Jeremiah. Now that's very significant because Jeremiah lived at what time? What happened in his lifetime? Babylonian captivity. So why does he write 1 and 2 Kings, which is essentially political history? It's how on earth did we get in this mess? How did this happen? It's from that perspective. Or who is it that wrote 1 and 2 Chronicles? Ezra. Ezra was not a prophet. He was a prophet, I guess, but he was a scribe. He was connected to the temple. And Chronicles is telling essentially the same story as 1 and 2 Kings, but from a slightly different perspective. It's from the perspective of the temple. And remember, Ezra is one of those who was involved in the restoration of the new temple. So he's writing this from the perspective of, let's see what terrible mistakes we made, and how can we avoid those, and how can we move into the future. So if we look at who wrote Judges, the book of Judges, the traditional author always assigned, and why would we think we know more than the Jews, who kept these books for, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, the traditional author always named as Samuel. Now that's very significant. Because what happened in the lifetime of Samuel?
King of kings.
That's right. He was the man who anointed the first king. He is the man who, if you will, was used to initiate the monarchy in Israel. Now, what we see, and again, none of this is going to be utterly new to you. I'm probably not going to say anything that's utterly new to you. But what we see gradually through the Bible is the maturation and growth of the human race. We're growing up, just like an individual grows up. So when the Jews are, they're growing up here. Who's the world's first grown up? I know you've heard me say this, I think. Who's the world's first grown up?
Jesus.
Excellent. See, if you don't know the answer, you say Jesus. And that's almost always... That's almost always right. Jesus is the world's first grown-up. Everybody before Jesus was at least slightly less than adult. And if you spend time in the pre-Christian world, you will have this feeling. And you've got to be careful how you say this when you come back to America or you come back to Europe. But when we spent time in India, you really had this sense that you would go stand in the line at the train station and the Indians, "Oh, sir, you please go ahead of us." And as Americans, we're so egal, we don't know what to do with this. But they regard you, if you're a European or American, in the cities it might be different, but you get out away from the cities, they regard you with almost a kind of veneration. There's a sort of adulthood that you are considered to have. Now, that's disappearing, that's changing, but that would be true all over what we call the third world, which is really the pre-Christian world. And it's strange to you as an American, when we had a cook, Daniel and his family cook, and I'm just a naive American, tried to buddy up to him, you know, Daniel. They were offended. Oh, no, they are here to serve you. And you are sir, and Carla, my wife, is ma'am. It's a very different feeling. Jesus is the world's first grown-up, and everybody prior to him was not quite adult. Even the most adult of people in the ancient world were not quite adult. And now, the whole object of the church, we're told in Ephesians, is to grow up into the full measure of the stature of Christ. So what we find is that the Jews, who really are the kernel of the human race, the Hebrew people, they're beginning to grow up. And what happens? Your kids get to be about 15 or 16 and they suddenly won't do anything Dad says, and they're breaking all the rules, and they're just wreaking havoc. What do you have to do when you've tried everything? What do you finally have to do? You have to kick them out of the house. That's what God did. He's got a bunch of snot-nosed teenage kids. So he kicks them out of the house and he says, you can come home when you've learned a thing or two. And that's exactly what happened. And they continue to grow up. So you have this process of people beginning to grow up from a very young age. And when they are called out of Egypt, they really are children. And they're taken into the promised land after a 40-year process of maturation, which was very hard on them. But that next generation was one of the few really righteous generations. They go into the land, and one of the most significant things that happens, God tells them immediately. He says, now when you get into the land, and you see, this is part of what I want to do is offer a kind of apologetic for this. I don't know about where you come from, but where I come from, people say, oh, the Bible, what a wicked book. It's full of genocide and, you know, killing your own children and killing people of other religions, and how awful. Now, I want to give a kind of apologetic for that before we're done this morning. But you see, one of the things, because we know that when the Israelites went into the land of Canaan, what did God tell them that they had to do?
Wipe these people out.
Wipe them out. Right. Wipe them. Now, there's nothing more offensive to the modern, modern idea than, what? This is genocide. You go in and you wipe the people out. Men, women, children, cows, camels, everything. You just wipe them out. Now, you've had Jim here, so Jim, as you probably heard Jim say this, because I got this from Jim. But what does the law tell us? The law tells us essentially three things. It says, taste not. It's a bunch of knots. Taste not, touch not, handle not. And the law is what enforces that. Now, I've got a little 4-year-old granddaughter, and when she comes to our house, we pick up everything that she might be tempted to put in her mouth, because she'll be tempted to put everything in her mouth. So we baby-proof the house. You got to baby-proof the house, because she's not mature enough to know what certain things are for. So you pick them up off the floor. She'll hurt herself with them, or she'll wreck them, you know, or whatever. So you baby-proof the house. The essence of the law is, at least from one perspective, taste not, touch not, handle not. What God is doing is baby-proofing the world. These are still children. And God knows if they go into Canaan, which is full of sex and death religion, it's all it is, sex and death. It's filled with wild orgies, and then the children that emerge from these orgies, you sacrifice to horrible gods. You burn them alive. And it is really, really awful stuff. And God knows that they are not mature enough to deal with that. So he baby-proofs the world. He says, when you go in there, we're going to just have to clean house. Because what God wants to do is establish a toehold somewhere in the world where true worship and true religion can be established. And in order for that to happen, these people have got to be protected from themselves, because they will be They'll be sucked into this. The moment they, this is amazing. We've never seen anything like this. They were over and over and over and over and over. That's the whole story of the book of Judges, is how they are continually pulled into Canaanite sex and death religion, false worship, and it corrupts them. So one of the very significant things that happens at the opening of the book of Judges, God told them through Joshua, when you go into the land, wipe them out. And they didn't do this. It says, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean. Ephraim didn't do it. Zebulun, and nobody did it. Didn't do it the way they were supposed to. So in the second chapter, an angel shows up and says, you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you not done this? Therefore I also say to you, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. See, over and over and over, what happens in the Old Testament is God says, oh, you think those gods over next door are really cool? You really like them, huh? Okay, well, you can go live under them and we'll see how you like it. So they get a very long, hundreds of years education. And it turns out they don't like it. It turns out they lose their liberty every time they come under these gods and they are made slaves. And then the story of the book of Judges, of course, it's really kind of like this. What you're seeing as you... They start out up here. God has liberated them from slavery. And he's given them their own land after 40 years of discipline. And they come into the land and wow, it's just great. And yeah, then they... See, and it keeps going like this and like this and like this and like this until finally you're... And every time what happens, they get down here and it says, oh, you know, say things like, and for 40 years, they were oppressed by the Canaanites and the Philistines. And they cried out to the Lord. And what did the Lord do? Why, he raised up a deliverer. He raised up a judge. And this judge just comes out of nowhere usually. I mean, he's not somebody who was groomed for this. It's the Spirit of God comes, calls somebody, and they're called. And they are extraordinary military deliverers. And they deliver the people. And then they govern the people as a judge for, you know, 10 years, 40 years, 30 years. It's all over the place. And this happens, so they have this nice period of time when they remember the Lord, but then they forget again, and they're ensnared in their neighbor's gods. And this just happens over and over and over and over until finally you get to the end of the book, and it's just catastrophe. Well, now, in order for us to understand what's going on in the book of Judges, let me do this. This is actually very important. We have to go back to, this is the nation of Israel. And the nation of Israel, who was Israel? What was his name originally? Jacob. And his name was changed to Israel. Now, Jacob is a Jim and I, Jim Jordan. We always have a little dispute. I think Jim is too nice to Jacob. I say it. He always points to the passages, and he was a perfect man. I'll give you my take on Jacob. I heard a pastor from the Christian Reformed Church, Dutch church, you know, and he said, he used this as an illustration. He said, you know, in Holland, the generation that grew up after World War II had all kinds of problems. And the reason they did, interestingly, is because they observed their parents in the highest, most difficult kind of moral behavior that is conceivable. Now remember, Holland was occupied by the Nazis. And what do you think these righteous, godly, Christian Reformed people did? Dutch Reformed people. What do you think they did in relationship to the Nazis? Not a whole lot of them. Some of them did. No, I'm actually talking about the good side of it. What'd they do? They lied continuously. Some of them did cooperate, but some of them didn't. And they didn't cooperate. And these children growing up in these Dutch Reformed homes, and I'm talking about the best of it, they saw their parents lie, deceive, swindle, cheat, and you know what? It was the highest form of moral activity one could possibly engage in. But when you're teaching anything, if I was going to teach a child mathematics, would I start with trigonometry or calculus? No, you start out with 1 plus 1 is 2, and 2 plus 2 is 4. If you're going to teach ethics to children, you don't start out with all of the exceptions. You start out with, and you never, never, never tell a lie. You start out with what's really simple and basic, right? So you never, never, never tell a lie. Then Johnny gets to be about 12 or 14 or 15, and one day some bullies come around from a gang, and they're going to beat up Johnny's friend. Say, "Where's Ben? If you don't tell us, we're going to go pound his face in." And now he's got a dilemma. I have to choose between protecting my friend and telling the truth. Now, if he protects his friend and he lies, he's done the right thing. But that's pretty complicated. You don't tell a 5-year-old that. You're not ready for that till you're 12 or 13 or 14. You know, and you may find, see, what always makes ethics interesting is what, you know, conflict of duties. There's this duty to tell the truth, and there's this duty to protect human life. And there are times when protecting human life takes priority over telling the truth. Now, if you look at Jacob, Jacob grew up, and his daddy Isaac favored his twin brother for 77 years. And, you know, what we're told is one story, particularly serious story, about Mama and Jacob deceiving Daddy, right? Did Mama and Jacob sin when they deceived Daddy? I don't think so. I think it was a righteous act. But do you know how... See, that's just one story. What we're really seeing here is, if you will, you're seeing the dynamics of a dysfunctional family at work before your very eyes. Do you think after years and years and years of this, culminating finally in this, where Daddy is deceived because he's about to do exactly the wrong thing with brothers in terms of who gets the priority and so on, so they deceive Pop, and then Jacob has to run away. Do you think Jacob might be a little mixed up? I think Jacob might have all kinds of conflicts in his life. Otherwise, I don't know how you explain the fact that he runs away to Uncle Laban's, and then you find, see, the Bible's full of this sort of typology, which you guys, you're really good at all this sort of thing. Jacob deceived his father when he was what? He was blind, right? That's when he deceived him. Jacob is deceived by Uncle Laban when? In the middle of the night when he's given his first wife. He goes into that tent. He doesn't know who it is till morning. He's what? He's blind. See, that's interesting. It's interesting. What I'm saying, it looks to me like Jacob received a whole lot of discipline. Not because he was a sinner, but because he's conflicted. And a lot of us are really conflicted. And God is working out the conflicts in our life, and it's painful, and it's complicated. And it doesn't mean you're evil, wicked, bad, awful. It means God is disciplining you so there's a clarity about you, and you're not just filled with crinkles and conflicts. All right? So he ends up with two wives instead of one. He gets the wife he has to work another 7 years to get Rachel. That's who he really loves. But he gets Leah as well. And as is often the case, you know, what you see with after they're married, he's got two wives, and now you've got this divided, conflicted household where there is all this awful rivalry that goes on. And as is so often the case in the Bible, one of these women is barren. All these barren women in the Old Testament. Barren women, what does barrenness finally culminate in, by the way? See, you have all these special prophets and righteous people. One of the marks of them is they're born to barren women. God made their miraculous birth. What's the final barrenness? Who's the finally barren woman? a virgin. She's more barren than anyone. So Jesus being born to a virgin is the culmination of all of this barrenness that we see in the Old Testament. All right? So every time Jacob breathes on Leah, she gets pregnant. But poor Rachel, she just can't have any kids until very, very late in life. And then she finally does. But what we find is, you know, you really feel sorry for Jacob. It's like he's coming home at night and he doesn't know. They start having these contests, and then it's not good enough for them to have children. They go, here's my handmaiden, which is a common practice. You take her and we'll have, and therefore my side of the household, her children will be my children. So Leah has Zilpah, who is her handmaiden, and Rachel has Bilhah, who is her handmaiden. And you get all these kids who come out of handmaidens and so on. Rachel finally has two children. And who are the two children she has? Joseph and Benjamin. Now, and then you've got, for example, Bilhah, who is Rachel's handmaiden. She gives birth to Dan and Naphtali. Leah, who gives birth to, she gives birth to, let's see here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. She has 7 children, and her handmaiden has 2, Gad and Asher. So it gets really complicated. And you have all this conflict between these various houses. And in the Bible, over and over and over, what we find is something called, there is something in the ancient world, and something that you find, it actually makes a good deal of sense in an agricultural world. It's called the law of primogeniture. What's the law of primogeniture?
Firstborn
inherits either everything or the vast majority of it. Now, that actually makes sense if you have an agricultural context. See, and you, if you were to divide up your land evenly between all 10 children, and this goes on for, in about 3 generations, everybody's going to inherit about 3 inches of land. It's also the source of new economic growth, because if the eldest son inherits either all the land or the vast majority of it, it means the others have got to go off to the city, and you begin to have a city economy that begins to develop. But it produces economic pressure. But at any rate, the law of primogeniture. And what we find over and over and over and over in the Old Testament is the law of primogeniture is overturned. And instead of the eldest being the one who becomes the ruler and the inheritor, it is often the youngest. God is overturning. God overturns. Actually, it's one way to read Romans chapter 9. Everything that's natural, God overturns. You can see that all through Romans 9. And one of the things you see is he overturns primogeniture. So that it's sometimes the youngest. So which number was David, for example? Number 8. And we're explicitly told in 1 Chronicles, I think it's 5, the primogeniture was overturned in the life in the sons of Jacob. And who is it that really becomes the primary son?
Joseph.
Yeah, that's right. Becomes the prime minister of Egypt. Now, remember, this is the household of Rachel. What we are promised, what we are told, is that in the end, that it is the household of Leah that will regain primacy. And who is actually the firstborn of Jacob? Anybody remember?
Reuben.
And Reuben was discounted because it says he went up to his father's concubines. So he's disinherited. And the second one is Simeon. The third one is Levi. They are disinherited for what reason? You remember? Yes. What they did to the Gideonites over Dinah, their sister. And there's an interesting, we all know there's an interesting, the curse on Levi is, turns out to be a blessing. They're scattered in Israel and divided in, how's it say, scattered and divided. So the division that goes on with Levi They're scattered through all the tribes. They become the priestly tribe. Turns out to be a blessing for them. But they do not inherit the firstborn. So it finally comes down to Judah, who's actually the fourthborn. But for a long time, the tribe of Judah is subordinate, this is the household of Leah, is subordinate to the household of Rachel for a long time. And Joseph had two sons. What were their names?
Ephraim
and Manasseh. Oh, let's see. There's a couple of doubles there, but I think that's close enough. You know what I mean. Ephraim and Manasseh. So you have really here, you've got the tribe of Benjamin, and you don't have a tribe of Joseph. What you have instead is the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh. And then you have the tribes, the tribes of Dan and Naphtali. Now, when you move through the book of Judges, it's not total. You actually do have judges who come from the household of Leah, but not very many, and none of the really significant ones. For example, Gideon. Gideon, I think, is a Manassite, if I remember. And even earlier on, when you have the two righteous men, you've got Joshua and you've got Caleb. Now, Caleb is from the tribe of Judah, as I remember, but he's not very dominant. Joshua is an Ephraimite. And as you move through the book of Judges, while there are some judges that come from the household of Leah, really, very, very predominantly, the leadership all come from the household of Rachel. And you have this rivalry that goes on. Pardon?
Even the first king.
Yes. Yes, that's right. It's all the household of Rachel. And the Ephraimites are the tribe that have the great predominance. Now, the very last great judge of the book of Judges is which judge?
Samuel.
Well, okay, Samuel, but I mean in the book of Judges.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Samson. Samson's from which tribe?
Dan,
which is the household of Rachel. Gideon is also from the household of Rachel. Deborah is from the household of Rachel. All of the really predominant judges are from the household of Rachel. Now, what you said is exactly true. When you come to the time of the monarchy, and the monarchy is a big change, we're going to move from being a nation that is our people, tribal peoples that are ruled by these occasional charismatic military leaders that are just raised up by God out of nowhere, and we're going to have a stable monarchical leadership, and it really is a growth, it's a maturation, it's a great new, in the overall scene of things, it's a really great new development. But who's the first king that Israel gets? Saul from which house? Benjamin, household of Rachel. Now, every form of political government, Aristotle goes on and on about this, every form of political government has a strength and has a weakness, has an Achilles heel. So, for example, democracy has various strengths, but the great Achilles heel, democracy, it really has two Achilles heels. What are they? Anybody know what Aristotle says?
Mob rule,
it becomes the demos, which means the mob. That is the downside. And there's another downside.
It never becomes good, it never gets too bad.
Well, just mediocre. That probably is true, but that's not what Aristotle mentions. But you're probably right. Mediocrity tends to dominate. Foreign policy, pardon?
Inefficient?
Well, yeah, but you know every form of government is. It's foreign policy. You can't run foreign policy with a congregational vote. You just can't do it. So if you look at constitutional republic, which is a form of democracy that's modified, we had to fix some of those things. So our president, in terms of foreign policy, functions more like a monarch. Has to. In other ways, he's much more restrained. So he can't function like a monarch in terms of domestic policy. But when you look at monarchy, what is the great Achilles heel? See, one of the great strengths of monarchy is foreign policy. What's the great Achilles heel of democracy, of a monarchy? Anybody know?
Kill one man and destroy the whole state.
That's correct. So what? So carry on. You're on the right track. That's right. The problem of succession. So, yes.
There's another problem with governments, and it's, I think, recently been observed that it is a monopoly on the use of force that determines the limits and scope of its own power. And that's not just depravity, but that's a structural defect in and points to a need for some sort of innovation in governance. But it's especially the state. Has a problem of monopoly.
Right.
And every monopoly
has its own problems.
In the right quantity, quality, or price.
Right.
And so when your business, your service is conflict resolution and protection, you're not going to do those very well. And those are the things that God frequently judges nations for. And it's a structural defect in this form of governance. And it's something
well,
I think
actually,
God is leading us out of.
Now you're talking about constitutional republicanism? Or are you talking about any
monopoly?
Okay.
And where there's a forced monopoly, it's an economic issue.
That's right. It always is.
Yeah.
Always is. But what I'm interested in here primarily is that the Aristotle says the Achilles heel of monarchy is the problem of succession. So you think, for example, about Henry VIII. Why do they keep trying to have kids? So he could have a son, because he didn't want a civil war, because if he only had daughters, there was going to be vying with the nephews and so on. They were going to go to war with each other, and they would all kill each other until finally one of them gained predominance. So once a king dies, you have this terrible problem of succession. Now you see what happened in Israel, and this is so often the case. If Israel had only been willing to wait for 40 more years, they could have avoided so much trouble. But, oh no, we have to have a king today. We have to have a king right now. We want to be like the nations around us, which, by the way, the law says you can have a king so you can be like the nations around you. But it doesn't put the same emphasis on that phrase. They said, oh, we want to be cool like the Philistines are of it, or the Edomites who have a king. We want to be like that. They meant it in all the bad ways. So God said, okay, you want to have a king, you can have a king. And you're not going to like it. If you'd only waited 40 years, you could have had a really good king. But now you're going to have a really bad king. And this bad king is going to come from, typically, the house of Rachel. He is a Benjamite. So you have a problem of succession because the Benjamites, Samuel has secretly gone out and anointed somebody. And who do they secretly anoint? Nobody knows about this except Samuel and the family. Who do they anoint? David, who is God's called one, who is from the tribe of Judah, and it was prophesied that the tribe of Judah would eventually recover predominance. So if you have your Bibles with you, remember, Samuel is writing this, and what he's writing, see, it's not just a question of who has the power to do this or that, it's also a question of legitimacy. This government has got to be legitimate. So, for example, if you could prove that someone actually stole a presidential election in the United States, it would undermine that president's rule. I mean, you'd have to clearly demonstrate that. It couldn't just be a political ploy. But if it could be clearly demonstrated, you would say that government does not have legitimacy, right? All right, so what Samuel has got to do, because he secretly anointed this king, he's got to demonstrate that this is in fact the will of God, and there is legal legitimacy to a new state and a new head of state. So if you look at the book of Judges, it's very interesting. Whole book of Judges is a kind of apologetic for this. So it starts out, and this is immediately after the death of Joshua in the first chapter. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? And what does the second verse say? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. Oh, isn't that interesting? Judah. And then it goes on, the fourth verse, it says, then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men of Bezerah. And then if you go down to the 21st verse, we find that, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there 3,000 sons of Anak. But here's the 21st verse. But the children of who? Benjamin. Oh, interesting. Which tribe does Saul come from? Oh, it's the tribe of Benjamin. The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. Immediately begins with the failures of these people. And then what we find as we move through the book of Judges, you have this utter predominance everywhere, not complete, but you have predominance of the household of Rachel over against the household of Leah. And then you finally get to the last, this is just an interesting aside, you get to the last of the judges in the book of Judges, and it's who? Who's the last great judge?
Samson.
You know, somebody you want to make movies out of. He's a really interesting character. And what you're seeing is this, you're seeing this decline all through the book of Judges. Now, it's very interesting. Samson is one of the great signs of the terrible decadence and decline of the whole nation of Israel. See, if you went to, I think this would be true, and if this would be an offensive thing to say if we had certain people, but I don't think any nation state in Western Europe could today militarily defend itself. The United States has done it for 50 years. I don't think they have the will or the resources if they had to raise an army and actually, I don't know that they could do it. I doubt that they could. It's actually a sign of the weakening and decadence of the whole of Western Europe. Now, that's exactly the place that Israel came to. That's why Samson is raised up. He's a one-man army. Israel's so decadent, it can't even raise an army anymore. So God raises up a one-man army who protects the whole nation. And then you get, see, that's a terrible sign of the decline and decadence. The nation is beginning to fall into terrible, terrible decline. Now, we then begin to have, toward the end of the story of Samson, his death and so on, then you get to the 17th chapter on through the end of the book, and it kind of changes gears. And we begin to see a phrase that is very commonly associated with the book of Judges, kind of poetic refrain. What is that phrase? And in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now, when we hear that phrase, what we think of is, well, that's talking about the moral decadence of Israel. True, it is. But it has far profounder and deeper meaning than that, which you can discover if you go to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Go to Deuteronomy 12, go to the 8th verse, and the chapter in Deuteronomy 12 is about what these people are going to do when they get into the land. Because remember, this is Deuteronomy 12, so these people are out wandering. It's the children of Israel wandering in the wilderness. And God says, now when you get into the land, you will not do as you do out here. In the 12th chapter, the 8th verse, it says this, you shall not do as you are doing here today, every man doing what is right in his own eyes. Interesting. Exactly the same phrase. Every man doing what is right in his own eyes. And then it goes on and it describes how what you do here in the wilderness when you want to sacrifice an animal, you just go out and you find a rock in the desert and you slaughter the animal and you bleed it out there. He says you won't do that when you go into the land. I will establish a place where my name is, and this place became the place of Shiloh. Shiloh, and that's where God put the tabernacle, and you would go there and you would offer your sacrifice, and it would be done in the way that God said it was to be done. No longer every man doing what is right in his own eyes. In other words, what we are seeing from this simple phrase, it tells us a whole lot. What we are being told is, and in those days, There was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. That refrain is repeated 6 or 7 times toward the end of the book. What does it mean? What it means is that Israel needs a king, and it's telling you something. What is the primary reason that Israel needs a king? To what?
Centralize worship.
To centralize and purify and protect worship. That's the principal reason. While a king may be a military leader, a king may be a figurehead, a king may give a kind of central, might do lots of things, the central reason was to purify and establish worship in Israel. And what we're being told is that worship has been corrupted over and over and over and over. And you get to the end of the book of Judges, and it's a very long chapter, beginning with the 17th verse, and all of this happens. It's the Danites in the land of Ephraim. All that's significant because these are all from the household of Rachel. And what happens is there is a gentleman by the name of Micah who takes his inheritance he gets from his mother, which is a whole bunch of silver, really pretty silver, and he melts it down and makes a god. And then he gets his own private priest who happens to be a Levite, who runs his own private little temple, and who knows, I suppose they say they're worshiping Jehovah, but they're sure not doing it the way God says to do it. And all this is happening in the land of the Danites, and then a bunch of thugs come along and they steal this priest away, take him off to their own land. It's still off in the land of all, this is going on in the household of Leah. And then we're told at the end of the book about a Levite, story I'm sure you're all familiar with, which, by the way, I don't remember the feminist name, but a feminist theologian wrote a book called Texts of Terror. And this is her principal text. This shows how awful patriarchal the Bible is. So at any rate, this Levite has a concubine, and she runs away to her daddy's house because she doesn't like the way she's not happy in her household. And the Levite goes, finds out where she is. She's at daddy's house. He goes to get her. He's taking her home. And they're coming back, and they come through, actually, the town of Jerusalem. And there's all the Motel 6s are full. They can't. So they go on to the next town. And the next town that they go on to is Gibeah. And all the motels are full. They can't find a place to stay. So they're going to sleep out in the city square. And some nice gentleman comes along and says, see what I learned when I was doing my doctor of ministry. We traveled all over the world to do this. Every city in the world likes to brag it's the toughest city in the world. Toughest, meanest city in the world. Well, Gibeah was the toughest, meanest city in the world. They said, don't stay out here. It's not safe. This is like Central Park in New York City. You'll get robbed, beaten, killed. Come home to my house. So they go home to his house, and what we find is they go home, and then all these thugs surround the house, and they start beating on the door, and they say, "We know that you have guests in there. Send them out so we can know them." And he says, "It's a horrible thing. I'd never do that." So the Levite, he says, "Well, instead, he puts his own concubine out there, and they have their way with her all night long." And then the morning comes, and it's really awful. He walks out, and she's laying on the ground, and he kicks her and says, "Come on, get up, we got to go." She doesn't move. And she's dead. Well, it's not surprising. So he takes her body and chops it up in 12 pieces and sends these pieces all over Israel and says, "You got to come and do war. This terrible crime has happened." And who do they have to come and do war against? Who, by the way, what town is this? Does anybody know who comes from Gibeah?
Saul.
This is Saul's hometown. And the people that need to be gone to war with are the who? The Benjamites. Oh. Now, this story is a very familiar story. You've all heard it somewhere else. What story is being told? This is exactly, except for a few circumstantial changes, this is the story of what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. And the meaning of it is that here you've got Samson, Israel's so corrupt it can't even raise an army, and now Israel has become so corrupt it's not even Israel anymore. Israel is Sodom and Gomorrah. And in those days, every man did what was right in his own eyes. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And it's these Benjamites in Gibeah who finally demonstrate that Israel has turned into Sodom and Gomorrah. Golly, I think we need a new king. And what tribe do you think he should come from? See, it's an apologetic, a whole lot. Now, there are other things you can say about judges, but at the very lowest, it is a kind of apologetic for David. And David is the king who is going to restore worship, true worship, and bring new righteousness to Israel. That's his calling. Okay, I'll stop there and we can do whatever else.